My name is Bill Grace, and today's topic is sexism. I know that we have a lot of new folks in the village. How many people were at either of the talks last week on racism, leadership? A couple of you. Okay. We're going to just go over a couple points that we made in those sessions, but not spend a lot of time on them. But the first thing I'd like to do, one of the things I've been wanting to get better at is to get the group involved sooner, because I tend to talk too much. And so Nicholas is my assistant today. He's got some paper back there. What I want you to do is to divide up into kind of three equal-sized groups, one over by the windows, and you can do that right now, one by the back windows, and one kind of up by this blackboard. And Nick will bring around to you a piece of newsprint and a marker. And once you get into your area, divide about equal numbers, and I'll give you your instructions. For anyone listening to the tape, we're working in small groups, making several lists that you'll learn more about later. Okay, 10 more seconds. Add your final two or three words to the list.
No one who's successful is ever
Okay. All right. Let's stop the small group work, and if you would, go back to your seat and don't show your list to anyone from another group. Okay. Going to make a small point here, I hope, if it works, to demonstrate something about what our topic is today, institutional sexism. I'm going to ask the recorders from each of the groups to come up, and I'll take your descriptors to the wall here, and could you tell the group what you have? And don't tell us what your group represents, but come on up and we'll post your list. We'll call this Group A. Okay. Yeah, Group A, and your name is?
Leslie.
Leslie's going to read you their adjectives.
Ditzy, giver, nurturer, weak, motherly, tidy, passive, soft, quiet, sensitive, emotional, supportive, reliable, available, desirable, and beautiful.
Desirable, okay. Group B, Maria.
Okay. Male, handsome, female, sexy, aggressive, ruthless, young, white, educated, intelligent, creative, upper middle class, ethical, and single-minded.
Okay. Group C.
Strong, stoic, rational, aggressive twice, competitive, macho, athletic, insensitive, self-reliant, withdrawn, scientific, mathematical, and unemotional.
Okay. Now,
try to read it in character.
When I, thank you all. When I read your group's list, please don't comment. We're going to let the other groups comment on your list for now. So groups other than, people other than in Group A, what do you think this list is describing? Ditzy, giver, nurturer, weak, motherly. What are we describing? Groups B or C?
Stereotypical
description of women. Okay. Now groups A and C can comment. Aggressive, ruthless, young, white, educated, intelligent, creative, ethical, single-minded. Groups A and C, what are we describing? Stereotypical men. Okay, now groups A and B can comment. Wage earner, strong, stoic, rational, aggressive, competitive, macho.
Men.
Men?
Yeah.
Anybody else from A or B? I asked group C, well, someone in group C, what did I ask you to describe?
We were actually Group B that you had.
Oh, okay. All
right. Just group B.
Right.
We were Group B over here.
So this is yours.
C is over here.
So this is stereotypical men.
Yeah.
Right? This is group B.
Yeah.
Okay. This is group C. What were you?
You were successful
in
capitalist culture.
Okay. Sorry I got that confused. But what we described first of all was stereotypical women, stereotypical view of men, and then I asked the other group to describe what does it take to be successful in a capitalistic culture? And notice how close the male list and the descriptors of what it takes to be successful in a capitalistic culture are. Does anybody want to make a comment on that? What does that tell us?
We're fine.
Can't hear you.
We bought into the male values as far as...
Maybe. We bought into the male values.
Sexism is ingrained in our culture, ingrained in our institutions.
All right. Sexism is ingrained in our culture and our institutions. I'd agree with that. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah. What do you mean by successful? I mean, is that...
What it takes to be successful in a capitalistic culture.
Yeah, do you mean making a lot of money or success in other ways?
Well, I didn't specify that, just to see what the group would come up with. And what the group came up with was a list of descriptors
that's
that...
That's why the word ethical is in there, because one person disagreed with...
Okay. You know, the point I'm making here is that malehood may be defined in our culture based on what it takes to be what it takes to be successful in a capitalistic culture. That could it be that malehood, as we have thought about it maybe prior to 5 or 6 years ago, was really based on what it took to be successful in a capitalistic culture, that men needed to be aggressive and ruthless. And as we think about men and we think about what it takes to be successful in a capitalistic culture, it's interesting you came up with similar lists, Deanna.
But it could go the other way, couldn't it? That what it takes to be successful has been defined by what we think men are.
It could. My own bias is that men are trapped into some socially prescribed roles in order to participate in a capitalistic culture. And what it requires of women is for women to maintain stereotypical roles to support men.
Isn't this success as described by the male culture, though?
Yes, absolutely.
So it would be, it's not going to be the same list, right? Because they're describing themselves.
You bet. Talk some more about your point.
Well, I think that the culture is dominated by this, or has been in the past, and so we're the ones that call the shots. And
you bet.
We're the ones that set up the stereotypes, live by them. And we're the ones that succeed by our own definition of success, which is making a lot of money.
I would add to that that the people who are most responsible for the organizations, the society in which we live, have sold men a bill of goods, which ultimately comes back and abuses women. Let me put this up and see if this makes sense. And those of you who are at the racism talk, this is going to be a little bit of overlap here. But all institutions are made up of four components. All institutions are made up of mission, power, structure, and resources. Any institution that you can think of has those four components, whether it's the church, the business that you work in. And for a moment, let's just take a look at America. Shout out, if you will, a color and a gender for who created the mission of America.
White males.
Who controls the power in America?
White males.
Who controls the structures, the vehicles through which things are done, policies and procedures?
White males.
Who controls the resources?
White males.
White males. I'm hearing some silence. Do we have any disagreement here? Are we in agreement that that's true? Well, this is a club then.
Maybe the resources are controlled by, behind that are controlled By women. Don't they compare?
Talk some more about that.
Well, I don't know much about that. So.
Where does the hunch come from? Because it was interesting. Somebody had a similar hunch in the racism talk, that somehow behind the scenes women are controlling resources.
Well, the statistics, I think I've read a statistic somewhere that women control 60% of the monetary resources in the United States, or something like that.
Does anybody want to take issue with that, Gina?
Well, I think we'd have to see which women control that 60%, because if it's indeed the case that women control 60% of the resources, it may be that those 60% of the resources are distributed around across so many or concentrated with a few. I don't know what the statistics would look like, but given what we read these days about the feminization of poverty,
yeah,
there are an awful lot of women that don't have access to any resources, and the women who do have access to resources might be quite identified with white men.
Here's the statistics as I understand it. In 1968, for every dollar a male earned, women earned 68 cents. Then we had the Equal Rights Amendment. Then we had all kinds of lobbying on behalf of women. We had a number of bills that were attempted to pass to get at fair wages. And here we are in 1990. Oops. And for every dollar a male earns, how much do women earn today?
64 cents.
The statistics that I have say 67 cents. It's 1 cent less. Let me paint out another example. Let's say husband and wife married for 10 or 15 years, they get a divorce. What happens to the male income typically?
Goes up.
What happens to the woman's income? The latest contribution to the homeless in the United States is which category? Women and children. So I would argue that resources are still in the hands of white males. Here's a little glimpse in a study done in 1972, and my hunch is that the numbers aren't that far off today. Let's say that this has nothing to do with the diamond model, so I'm not adding a hole to it. Let's take a look at a pie chart, and this pie would represent the individuals who are earning more than $15,000 a year. This is in 1972 money, so you'll have to translate that. What percentage of that, those people earning $15,000 a year or more in 1972 do you think were white men?
86%.
4%, the other 4% was divided between people of color and women. And that brings up another interesting phenomenon. You know, white male, there's the big pie, right? And so in the 60s, in the civil rights movement, the blacks stood up for themselves and said, we'd like a piece of the pie. This is our country too. We want a piece of the American dream. And so begrudgingly, we kind of said, okay. And so then the Hispanics said, hey, wait a minute. You know, what about black power? What about brown power? And they said, you bet, no problem. And then women said, what about us? You know, we'd like a piece of the pie too, you bet. And then people ask, why are minorities, why are people of color always fighting amongst themselves? And we victimize women and people of color in some interesting, similar ways. I'm going to ask two people to help me with two quick readings. Who would like to help me read? One from a text by Robert Terry, one from Scripture. Okay.
Maintenance of the basic racial controls is now less dependent upon specific discriminatory decisions. Such behavior has become so well institutionalized that the individual generally does not have to exercise a choice to operate in a racist and or sexist manner. The rules and procedures of the large organizations have already pre-structured the choice. The individual only has to conform to the operating norms of the organization and the institution will do the discriminating for him. Interestingly, the status of slaves paralleled the status of women in America, and slaves were often likened to women or children. As Gunnar Murdahl pointed out in the appendix to his famous book on racial discrimination, An American Dilemma.
Okay, now we have a reading from Exodus 20:17.
You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's.
So on a parallel, we see that, you know, men's male property, including, you know, their beasts, their other belongings, and their slaves and their women should not be coveted, kind of on an equal level there. And now you could finish your piece.
In the earlier common law, women and children were placed under the jurisdiction of the parental power. When the legal status had to be found for the imported Negro servants in the 17th century, the nearest and most natural analogy was the status of women and children. The Ninth Commandment, linking together women, servants, mules, and other property, could be invoked, as well as a great number of other passages of Holy Scripture.
Okay, great. Thanks, both of you. Okay, I'm trying to make a quick point here, because I'd like us to move on and get into some small group discussions in a little bit, is that institutional racism is connected to institutional sexism. And as a matter of fact, all of the isms are connected, and I'm going to make a point in a bit to demonstrate to you how sexual preferencism, the belief that heterosexuals ought to have more rights than gays or lesbians, is connected to this as well. And it's connected to male homophobia in particular. And let me make that bold statement and then try to demonstrate it. First of all, let me say this. There's a wonderful little book, and I can't tell you where to get it because I haven't seen it around in a while. It's called Off Their Backs and On Our Feet, Men's Dependency on Women. And the premise of the book is that women are caregivers in our culture, and men are dependent on them to be caregivers because men don't know how to be caregivers to each other. And the main reason why males aren't caregivers to each other and don't learn how to be caregivers to each other is homophobia. Picture this. Here's an example. Between undergraduate and graduate school, I was traveling in Turkey and was in Istanbul and met two friends who were from Afghanistan. They were both playing on the Afghanistanian soccer team, and we had not known each other before, and we're just traveling around together, so we decided to spend a couple days together in Istanbul. Well, if you've been there, or if you know anything about the culture, you know that saunas are a big part of the culture, and so after walking around the markets for a day, we decided to go take a sauna. And so we walked in with towels wrapped around ourselves and, you know, sat down to have a conversation. And I was laying down on the bench on my stomach, and one of the guys from Afghanistan came over and he started rubbing my back. And I'm going, wait a minute, there's something wrong here, you know. I just met this guy, and here I am in a sauna, just wrapped in a towel, and this guy is beginning to rub my body. Well, I decided to take a chance and to see what would happen, and as it happened, he just gave me a wonderful rub down, and like the sign on our little sauna says, nothing like a back rub in the sauna. But I realized, you know, for a few minutes there, that I was really panicked that this might be a kind of forced homosexual encounter. And it was interesting to me to think in that, back in that later, that that was my belief, that somehow male touch meant, you know, sexual intercourse. As it turned out, in Afghanistan, they don't have athletic trainers. They don't have people who do that for athletic teams. Everybody on the athletic team is trained as an athletic trainer. And so athletes, one of the roles you have as an athlete, one of the roles you have for your teammate is to rub his body or her body. That's one of the roles you have in being a teammate. Now, men in this culture, picture this. Picture the athletic club or the place where you might go to work out once a week. Picture the locker room. You walk into that locker room, and here are all of the men in the locker room laying face down on the benches, rubbing each other's bodies. Is that a normal picture in our culture? Does that cause a little bit of uneasiness?
Yes.
You know, men other than your spouses, think about where you might go for support. Do you seek out other men? Are you fortunate to have other men in your life or do you tell most of the things that are deepest in your heart to women? If you're a male and you find that you tell most of your inner thoughts to other women other than your spouse, you're not alone. Most men do that. Most men find it very difficult to confide in other men. There's another example of how male homophobia results in our dependency on women to play these roles, nurturer, caregiver, and men's inability to do that for each other locks women into those roles. And one of the beliefs I have is that, back to this notion of the culture, we believe that somehow if men start claiming the feminine voice in themselves, that we're not going to be as successful in the capitalistic society. Collaboration and friendships and partnerships really get in the way of the competitive climate on the trading floor. So what we see is that the capitalistic climate, homophobia, racism, all work together to keep women in their place. And that women's liberation is ultimately dependent on men learning to be caregivers to one another. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Let me do one other thing, and I promise we're going to get into small groups.
Bill?
Yes, Dan.
I think another connection, like in terms of your sauna example, is that it appears to me that the connection between heterosexism and sexism is also the reverse of that, that men sometimes fear, the fear of the gay thing is about that gay men are going to treat straight men the way straight men treat women. Hmm. I mean, the rape factor is this. The fear of attack, all that. I mean, I can never figure out where that comes from. But I see that connection between the possession and forceful, and that touch does lead to intercourse on the first date and all that stuff.
The prison jokes. You've heard, you know, don't bend over in the shower for a bar of soap.
That's the notion in homophobia, is that it's the ultimate insult to the male ego, that someone would mount a male. You know, that it is not in keeping with the male image that somehow we would be subservient in a sexual encounter. And you know, again, that's a big part of homophobia. I want to show you a grid just to let you know that as complex as this can get, and I really want to focus on the question of the feminine now, because I wanted to put it into context, and because this is a culture that we live in that is male biased, sexism is really dependent on the ending of sexism is depending on male behavior. Women asserting themselves, teaching us to use better pronouns, claiming their own voice is important, but men learning to, if I had the diamond model up there still, share the mission, share the power, share the resources, share the structure. That's what women's liberation is ultimately dependent on. And let me show you a little grid here that, if you're at the racism talk, this is, again, repetitive, but helpful, I think, if we want to understand what can we do. If we live in a culture that is sexist, because men control mission, power, structure, and resources, even if all of us in this room were of good will and didn't want sexism to exist anymore, it would, because it's in our structures, just like we read. So what we need to do is we need to act against it. We need to act against the cultural norm, because the cultural norm is sexism. So we only have four choices. The first one is that you can be sexist, or you can be anti-sexist, or you can be, and you can be active, or you can be passive. Let's take a look at all of those quadrants. Active sexes. My belief is that this is only about 5% of the American culture. That most people acting out intentionally to oppress women is a small portion of the culture. And we all know, you know, active male chauvinist pigs, and And but I think the good news is that the number is small.
Why do you put the number so small? I would put it up a lot higher.
Okay. Well, see, that's a male's perspective. How would you like to put the number?
Depends if you're talking about intentionally oppressing women or really actively being sexist.
Are you talking
about intention, or are you talking about what people actually do?
I'm talking about, and again, this is coming from a white male, so you need to correct me on. What I'm talking about is that people who act out in what I would call overt sexist behavior.
Would you call that the same thing as, I will hire this secretary because she's more attractive than this female applicant?
You bet.
Active sexism, isn't it?
You bet.
And I think that happens all the time.
So how would you like to raise that?
Are we only talking about men, or are we talking about the total population?
Let me finish the quantum. and I think it will make sense. We're talking about men here, okay? Because in this model, the sexism is dependent on this, prejudice. Prejudice plus power. You see, everybody in the room is prejudiced. But in this system, white men have power. So prejudice plus that power equals sexism. An act of prejudice on behalf of a woman in this culture doesn't result in sexism. In our culture, only men can be sexist. Because the culture is sexist, and it acts on behalf of men. Women can be prejudiced, but only men can be sexist. Deanna?
I'm not sure I agree with that, because it's possible for people to get through the system.
Sure it is.
You know, and so I think it's frequently the case that someone who's an outsider who makes it in this system adopts the ideals in such a way that they can be more oppressive, almost, than an insider who's made it.
So you're arguing that a woman could be sexist?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
And I would differ by virtue of the definition that because women can be prejudiced and blacks can be prejudiced, but in this culture, I would argue, and we can spend more time on it, you know, after the session, because I really don't want to get bogged down here, okay, that women, according to my model, I guess, of this, women really can't be sexist. Women can be prejudiced. Let me finish this and see if it makes sense.
And we're having an example of it right now, by the way.
How so?
With your interaction with these ladies.
But you have power by virtue of your position as much as your sex.
Okay. So how could I be more responsive?
Well, I was just observing something. I would say that there are
making
women.
Judgment.
That there are women who have power and who have prejudice, and therefore, by your definition, they would be sexist. But they might only be 5% of the population.
Can you have power without being prejudiced?
Sure.
Yes. Question.
For an example, where would you put a Phyllis Schlafly? She sounds like an actual sexist to me. I mean, I'm willing to go with your definition just for the purpose of semantics, but I would think of her as an active sexist.
I think she feeds the system. And we're getting hung up in terms here. And let me finish the grid, and if we want to come back here, that's great. But I'd like to finish this, but I really want to be sensitive to that, because the last thing I want to do is to act out what I'm trying to stop. I'm not even going to dare to put a number down, but I'm going to put down that this is small. Here's what I'd like to point out to you, that another choice, passive anti-sexist, that choice does not exist, because the culture is sexist. So this choice would assume that I could sit back and do nothing and things would be just fine for women, when in actuality, if I go about my daily business, I am participating as a sexist. Okay? So what's another choice? Passive sexist. And this is the one that I think is larger.
Can I give another term for that? It's a wonderful term, which is called a subterranean sexist.
You bet.
You know, and I think you've coped with it. I'm done with this.
That's right.
And then it's still...
The belief here is that, you know, hey, women are on the rise in this culture, things are fine. The real tough thing is to be a white male looking for a job, you know? The belief that somehow, if I just act normal, that things are fine. But acting normal in this culture is to be racist, is to be sexist. Our inaction allows the system that is currently oppressing to continue to do so. Okay? Your other choice is to be an active anti-sexist. And I'm going to say that this is somewhere in between. And my interest as a person is to move passive sexist down into active anti-status. My belief in dealing with any active bigot, whether it be race or gender, is to ignore them. If I heard a sexist comment, or I felt that a male chauvinist pig was trying to egg on people in a group and to say things that I knew weren't right, as I would do with a sexist, if the person was over here, I'd just turn my back at the person and say, I differ with that person. If you'd like to know why, speak to me afterwards. But not to engage the bigot is very important. So this is where I think white males need to be. White males need to consider, how can we become active anti-sexist? And I said something again that's got Deanna puzzling back there.
Well, so. Because it seems to me the only people who can confront someone who's in that upper left quadrant is someone who has power. And so, and credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people who are in that active sexist category will only listen to someone who is like them in many formal categories. Now let me give you an example of this. I just went through a review, as academics do all the time, and as I would relate the things that my colleagues said about me to people, either early in the conversation or late in the conversation, they'd say, you know, this is real gender related, but you can't bring it up.
You bet.
And who needs to bring it up is someone like them.
And most often when I'm in a group and I see something like that happening, something's happening in the group, not because somebody's intentionally trying to be evil, is what I would call this, but because somebody is unaware that just acting status quo is being sexist. So my role in groups is to say, hey, wait a minute, do we know what we're doing right now? When I say I don't want to actively engage the bigot, I'm talking about someone who is really unhealthy. And oftentimes I find that those people who are acting in that way are doing so for attention, and I don't want to add to that. But most sexist behavior I see in groups is what I would call comes from a lack of awareness than from a hatred of women. This is what I would say is based on a hatred. And this is what I would call is based on ignorance. And I think the ignorance is a lot more intense than the hatred.
So that your argument is, if you can get the people who are ignorant to move into the active anti-sexist category, the people with hatred won't have any power anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Here.
I think long range, that's right. But are you saying you use this same formula for racism?
You bet.
So if you're talking about an active racist organization that is lynching people or doing gay bashing on Capitol Hill in Seattle, that your way of handling them is to ignore them?
If I saw somebody trying to lynch somebody, I wouldn't ignore that. But
this isn't a joke, because
sure,
I think there are things
but
happening.
I want to clarify your question. I was saying, if somebody was being actively racist in a group and doing so to provoke the group, I have learned through my own experience the best thing for me to do is not to engage that person, but to tell the group that I differ and that I have some information, and anyone interested ought to see me.
Well,
but to take on that person, I just get into all of the...
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble with that. And if you're talking about just the best approach in terms of group dynamics, don't try to change people's minds, that's fine. But I'm really concerned about you saying to a group, the best way to handle active sexist or active racist is to turn your back and ignore them. That's a frightening thing, I think, to be suggesting to people individually or as a group. Because I think there are too many situations where that is exactly what we are doing, and that's exactly why they're getting away with violence.
Let me clarify then, because I don't mean to emphasize this quadrant too much. I believe that any act that oppresses someone else needs to be challenged. And I would want to role model that. What I have observed as a strategy is that if I have an active bigot in a room, one of the worst things I can do is to confront that person because it gives them more airtime.
Okay.
And one of the things that I've learned, therefore, is to try to recognize that this person is really a minority. But what I have to be worried about is that this person can sway these passives into more extreme sexist behavior. So my role is to worry about this group. And my belief is that because this person is often unhealthy, I'm not going to make a lot of progress with him. And my interest is dealing with the larger group. I see your point, and I really respect your point, because I would not want to promote that behavior. And by not confronting it, if I were promoting it, which I think is your point, that would be the last thing I'd want to do. And it's the last thing I'd want to encourage anybody to do. So thanks for clarifying.
So that her point means then, that if you see an active sexist who is in the act of causing harm, you confront the act.
You bet.
But not necessarily try to change the mind
right.
At that point. Mm-hmm. So you save someone who's drowning.
Good clarification. Comments, questions? Bill?
See, now I know why that left upper quadrant you had a smaller number.
Right.
Because I was thinking in terms of power. And that's where I still just, because if you think of the economic resources and everything, which are in the hands of the white male,
right.
Generally, I don't think that they do that, I may be wrong, based on hatred. I think it's because of all the other reasons. And I still think that it's a sexist, active sexist thing to deny one woman a job based on looks because there's another more attractive applicant for that. See, I don't know if it's hatred as much as just all the things that have been built into the male.
Yeah, and I would argue that it's ignorance, you know, and let me try to demonstrate that by asking us to take a gender IQ test. Do you have a pencil or paper? Who needs more copies? Does everybody get a copy? Okay. I'm thinking, you know, rather than taking this, what I'll do is give you a chance to collectively guess as a group and then tell you what this particular research institution says and in some cases why. This is from the Gender Equity Center in Washington, D.C., and research that they've conducted and also research that they've borrowed. These are all true false, by the way. Men talk more than women, true or false?
True.
True. Here's what they did. They brought men and women into different rooms, showed them a picture, and asked men and women simply, they gave them the instructions to describe it. The average woman took 2 minutes to describe the picture. The average male took 17 minutes. Men are more likely to interrupt women than they are to interrupt other men.
Yes.
It's very true. There are approximately 10 times as many sexual terms for males as for females in the English language.
False.
It's just the opposite. There's, according to this study, 25 names for men that refer to their sexuality and 250 for women. During conversations, women spend more time gazing at their partners than men do.
True.
That's true. Nonverbal messages carry more weight than verbal messages. True. So connect that back to number four, see what that tells you. Female managers communicate with more emotion and drama than male managers. That's false. And one of the beliefs is that women in management have believed that they need to kind of guard that side of themselves, that more responsive side, in order to fit a male stereotype in order to perform in the work setting. And therefore, women in a typical managerial setting act more similarly to the stereotypical male model. Seven. Men not only control the content of the conversation, but they also work harder in keeping the conversation going. It's actually false. Men usually do control content, but women are much more effective in keeping a conversation going. When people hear generic terms such as mankind or he, they respond inclusively, indicating that the term applies to both sexes. False. Multitude of studies show that when we hear a male pronoun, we think of men.
Bill, can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
Is this culture specific, like USA? I think of other cultures, you know, like Germany or whatever, where they carry on these discussions, and I think it's more subtle or it's more.
I really.
Is it bound by the last decade or the last two decades?
I really don't have any cross-cultural experience on that question. Does anyone else in the room have experience to say whether or not that truth has implications for other cultures?
It really depends on which dimension you're talking about. I mean, there's a whole wide spread along a lot of those things. So you really would have to take each one piece by piece. There's a book written by a guy named Hofstede, a Dutch sociologist in 1980, where he looks at a lot of these gender-related issues across about five different European cultures and some Asian and African cultures. And that's a good source to see how it differs. But it even differs within European cultures. So.
Okay. All right. In the classroom communications, male students receive more reprimands and criticisms than female students.
False.
It's actually true. But I'd like to connect that with 19. In classroom communications, teachers are more likely to give verbal praise to females than to males. That's false. And the notion is that men get more positive praise and men get more criticism. And what that results in is that men get more attention. And we all know that people who love us both praise us and criticize us. And one of the things that is the opposite of love is indifference, and that is how women are treated in the classroom, apparently.
How about number 9,
Okay. Women are more likely to touch others than men are.
True.
That's true. Women. I'm skipping to 11. Women are more likely than men to disclose information on intimate personal concerns. True. That's true. Female speakers are more animated in their conversational style than are male speakers.
False.
That's false, according to this same study, probably for the same reason, that women oftentimes in that role of public speaking believe that they need to come across more professional, and therefore, at least at this point, which is about 5 years old, believed that they were holding back something. Women use less personal, but you see, that's a form of institutional sexism, isn't it? That women think that they need to act a certain way in order to be successful. And so they become less themselves. That's ultimately what sexism robs us of, by the way. Is that it robs us of the feminine, all of us. Women act less out of the feminine voice, and so do men. And so what we have is a culture, in some ways, out of balance, and operating oftentimes with less than half the truth. Women use less personal space than men.
True.
Did I skip one? No. When a male speaks, he is listened to more carefully than a female speaker, even when she makes the identical presentation. That's very true. Women are more likely to answer questions that are not addressed to them.
No.
That's false. Men do that often. There is widespread sex segregation in schools, and it hinders effective classroom communication. That's true. If you want to read an intro, oh, sorry. In general, women speak in a more tentative style than do men.
True.
That's very true. If you look at conversation kind of starters, well, I'm not really sure about this. You may disagree. I think I remember this correctly. Women typically use phrases like that more often than men. In what?
Tags.
Give us an example of a tag.
Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
Don't you think so?
Mm-hmm. Good point. Okay. Female managers are seen by both male and female subordinates as better communicators than male managers. That's true. In general, men smile more often than women. I hate to say it, I couldn't find the research on that one, so I don't know. So my response to us was going to be, you know, let's all smile and not let the stereotype work. I'm going to just summarize a couple of key points because I want to get us into some small group discussions. And, at first I felt like we were getting bogged down here, but I appreciate the challenges here because I think it really caused me to clarify some things, and I hope that was helpful for the whole group. What we talked about is that descriptors of women in this culture and descriptors of men are somehow connected to what we think requires us in our personalities to be successful in a capitalistic society. And that limits men and therefore limits women. The diamond model. We live in a culture that is institutionally sexist. Therefore, if we do nothing, we pass it on. So I use a term to describe myself, and I do it with some caution because I don't want to be misinterpreted. To say that I am an anti-sexist, that's a pretty powerful label to put on myself because it means, hey, you can trust me. I've arrived. I'm one of the enlightened men. And that's not true. I have a friend who believes that because these systems back to the diamond model, are really unhealthy systems that we're all kind of recovering from them. So I'm a recovering sexist. I'm a recovering racist. I'm a recovering sexual preferencist. I need to remind myself every day when I'm in a group, wait a minute, was that a sexist comment? Was that a racist comment? Is that something that just oppressed gays and lesbians? Was I participating in that? Do I need to do something? If I don't examine that each day, and just like the alcoholic who's in recovery, make a choice each day to do something healthy, I slip back here. It's not easy to swim upstream in a culture that's racist and sexist and add the other isms. All of the messages in the culture serve to reinforce this. And so our challenge is, how are we going to support each other to do this? And the answer is, every day. Every day. Let me stop there before I get us into small groups, just for a couple minutes. Questions? Okay, why don't you get into small groups of no more than five so that we can make sure everyone has a chance to talk. And I'm going to put some questions on the board for you. A couple minutes, actually. Which church structures oppress women? I'd like us just to be aware of that. Think, all structures oppress. But I wanted to focus on the church. How are women oppressed in the church is another way of asking that question. Flip side of that question, I think, is how can the feminine perspective on things empower the church? And that, what's one thing you'll do to have that happen, believing that that's going to help make the church less oppressive?